we have been discussing for a number of weeks now, and maybe it's almost time to move on, but discussing one of the most important stories I think there is. And that is the story of the Tree of Knowledge and Adam and Eve, and they're eating from the Tree of Knowledge. And we've been discussing most recently the question of what was this Tree of Knowledge, and what knowledge of good and evil did it give Adam and Eve after they ate it, and how are we meant to interpret this story? And we've had a lot of important, I think, ideas in relation to that. But it's mostly till now we've essentially been discussing the cognitive approach, meaning Adam and Eve gained some sort of new intellectual perspective by eating from the Tree of Knowledge. Last week, we discussed the notion of choice and the notion of the will to choose and how free will sort of, on the one hand, is our greatest strength, on the other hand, leads to our greatest failures and downfalls. So this week, I want to present a different perspective, but it's an important one. And again, I think that it helps us grapple with what it means to be human. So I think that's what this story is really about, the story of humanity itself. Okay, so again, hopefully everyone has the source sheet, and let's begin. So first, to sort of drop the bomb, this is not necessarily how I would have read the story, but if you have source one and two, we have the Ibn Ezra and Abarbanel's interpretation of Da'at Tov Vara. And what they tell you is this here is titled The Tree of Intimacy, that translating it as a tree of knowledge isn't accurate. It's not really about knowledge at all. Take a look at Ibn Ezra, source number one. Eitz Hada'at Lehosif al Tavat HaMishkal. What the tree of quote-unquote knowledge did is increase the desire for intercourse. That's what it did. Da'at does not mean knowledge, intellectual knowledge. It means intercourse. Ki ha'na'ar lo yavin ben tov l'ra. Why do we call it da'at? We'll get to other explanations a little bit later. But a young man doesn't understand the difference yet between good and evil. Rak be'et shi'achel l'chsof l'ta'avat hanashim. Only when they reach the age in which they have this desire for women. Akein nikra ha'mishkav yidi'ah. Therefore, intercourse is referred to as knowledge. Namely, that knowledge is a sign of maturity, and one surefire sign of maturity is puberty and the desire for sexuality and for intercourse. And so that's what happened. Cain, and he gives two examples, two well-known or less well-known examples. Number one, Adam yada et chava isho, right? Adam had known his wife Eve. Doesn't just mean they got to know each other well, because the next sentence is, and then Eve became pregnant and bore Cain, right? So that clearly means intimacy. He knew her intimately. And secondly, v'nei de'ah otam, and we shall know them. So that's from the story of Sodom. If you remember the story, the people of Sodom knock on Lot's door, and they aren't too happy with his guests, and they say, kick them out and we shall know them. And I don't think what they meant was we're going to introduce ourselves and get to know what their favorite flavor of ice cream was. Neda otam means, there's a reason it's called sodomy. Neda otam means that they wanted to rape them, right? So we had therefore demonstrated that the word lada'at can sometimes mean intimacy. So that's point one. The Abarbanel, who we're going to focus on tonight, brings it a step further. And I think the ingenious part is moving back to what Eve said, right? If you remember when the Nahash, the serpent, says to Eve, hey, is it true that God told you not to eat from all the trees of the garden? What does Eve respond? What does Eve respond to the Nahash? The Nahash says, is it really true that God said, don't eat from all the trees of the garden? He responds, no, there's just one tree he said that we should not eat or even touch. We shouldn't even touch that tree. Now, if you remember, is it true that God said not to touch the tree? No, it is not. It is not true that God said not to touch the tree. So other commentaries sort of get at the point that Chava was sort of creating her own prohibition, maybe as a safeguard. But the Abarbanel here says it was wrong. In fact, God did want them to touch the tree. And therefore, he says as follows, okay? Elisha emet bazehu ma shezacharti, shahaya eitz hadat hahu me'orer umarbe betavat hamishka. Again, that what the truth is about this tree, he rejects the Ramban, who says it's about will. He says, of course they had free will. How else could they have sinned? Rather, what it did was it aroused and multiplied the lust for intercourse. Some of that desire, and I want to think about this at Barbanel for a bit. Some desire is healthy, is good. It would have been good for them to touch the tree because it would have been good for them to have a healthy desire for sexuality. But when it became multiplied, there was an abundance of it, that was bad. Too much desire was bad. And it distances a person from perfection. Good and evil. It's the tree of intimacy, not knowledge, because knowledge is not what's at stake here. They didn't know anything more, but it's the tree of intimacy of good and evil. Why good and evil? Barbanel says as follows. The beginning of the approach to this tree was good. It's a good tree. It's an important part of our life.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Shall I do it on the phone? Well, we were
Okay, I don't know if that's intended for us. Sorry about that. Okay, so so it's good and evil. Why? The beginning is good. Viribuyo ra, but too much of this lust is evil. So it's good and evil. You have to have moderation in this tree. It's never the tree of intimacy of evil and good. It's tovara. The beginning, the initial approach to the tree, good. Too much. The end of it is evil. So first of all, the Abarbanel is dealing with a bunch of issues here, right? One is with this tree of intimacy. So there's a few questions you might ask, right? Why did God put the tree there at all if it was just bad? If it was an evil tree, if it was bad, if God didn't want them to eat from it, why did he put it there? Now you can answer that question. And the other question is, how do we deal with the touching issue? And the Rabbi Ravanel says here is that it's not necessarily a bad tree. It's a good tree. If used appropriately. It would have been a good tree had Adam and Eve used it appropriately, but they ate from it. They didn't just touch it. And that's where he continues over here. Torah did not prevent Adam and Eve from touching the tree or feeling it. That would have helped a lot. Now it's interesting. So the question to think about is, what is the proper usage of this drive? What would have been the right approach? So he says as follows. We could have used it, and I'm not sure I'm going to necessarily agree with everything or only present this viewpoint. He could have used it to be in cohab with his wife and to have similar children. He says, good, what would the good thing have been? To use it for a good, natural purpose. That's what the tree of knowledge was for, not of intimacy. And not for being steeped in an animalistic, shameful sensuality. That was bad. Therefore, that's the nakedness, right? When you read the story, there's a lot of nakedness. a lot of nakedness. Before the story, they were naked, as we'll see, and they didn't, they weren't embarrassed. After the story, they eat from the tree. What do they realize? They realize that they are naked. What's with the nakedness? Why is that important? For the Barbanel, it's very clear. Beforehand, there was no shame involved at all with the desire for sexuality. There is no shame involved. Afterward, however, after they eat from the tree and not just touch it and not just interact with it, but consume it and make it a very important part of who, or fundamental part of who they are, then it becomes shameful. And that's his point. So that's why they weren't embarrassed. Because the other limbs, the limbs necessary for reproduction, were the same as all the other limbs, like hands and feet. They have a function, and they perform that function, and there's nothing to be ashamed of, right? Sort of the opposite where the Rambam says it's obvious that there's nothing more shameful than walking around naked, and in terms of society, the Barbanel saying here, no, there's really nothing shameful at all at a simple level. What's shameful about those organs? They're perfectly normal. And that's what it was before this thing. Let me just finish. I want to hear what everyone has to say. He says it wasn't nakedness. They didn't see this as nakedness. There's nothing. It's just a good, important part of their experience. But God said you can't eat from it. Because eating from it brings a person to this increase of lust and pursuit of this shameful animalistic act, the lola taflut hagun mnautzichli, without any proper purpose. Eating and making it part of who you are, zelavadonasar ladam, that was forbidden to men. They rove hazeko she'ein ra yoter gadol imenu. Because of the great damage eating caused, there is no greater evil than it. And that is the Barbanel. So the Barbanel says, in a word, what did eating from the tree of knowledge do? It amplified the desire for sexuality. It amplified the lust to an unhealthy degree. There would have been a healthy degree beforehand, and even more, even to increase it. But eating from it raised it to a level which was inappropriate. So what do we think about this explanation? And I mean that as, what do you think about it in terms of the story and how it explains the story? And what do you think in terms of the theology involved, this perspective on sexuality? Yes, Paul.
One question I have, if it's a decent, proper purpose, why are children brought forth in pain?
Ah, this is a good question. This is a good question. Maybe it's part of the punishment. But this is a good
part of the what? I'm sorry.
The punishment.
Part of the what?
The punishment for eating from the tree. Maybe it wasn't supposed to be that way.
But right? It's only the woman who goes in pain.
Why is only the woman the one who bears children?
Why is the woman the only one in pain?
She's the one. Well, so hold on. I want to get to that. Let's not jump the gun, but I want to get to that. Look, I'm not going to happens to be, I don't know, I don't see any women over here. So I don't know. I feel like it's unfair to sort of give an answer to that without them to represent themselves. But I want to get to that. But what do you think about this explanation? Let me ask this question. Looking through the story, do you think it's a good read of the story in terms of the context of the story, what happens before and afterward? Or do you think it's a bit far-fetched in terms of how to interpret this? What do you think? Avram, you're saying something? You're muted.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I think it's a bit far-fetched.
What's far-fetched about it?
Dahlia, you just can't do that.
Yeah.
Can we mute everybody?
Ralph, you need to mute. We can hear Kitty. Ralph.
Okay. Mute.
Sorry about that. Yeah, so you're saying? Okay, now I got on mute. one of those days. Yeah, go for it. Albert, you're muted.
All right. So Hashem put Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden with the intention of procreating.
Ah.
Is that correct?
That's so, an interesting question.
No, only because if they were meant to have children, they would automatically would have the desire to have children, which means having sexual intercourse.
Right.
So.
And the knowledge. And the knowledge, Albert.
What? Right. The knowledge of what?
How to do it.
Yeah.
That would come pretty normal, I think. Well, but anyway.
What's normal these days?
All right. All right. Yeah, you know, I hear you.
So in that case, then the tree itself doesn't represent that he's going to learn something from it, which means
Two points to respond. One is that when you say that Adam and Eve were intended to have more children, it's not necessarily so. Although we're going to see that Rashi certainly thinks that. And Cain and Hevel might actually have been born before they left the Garden of Eden, according to one opinion. But if you think about it this way, some say that if they were going to live forever, then maybe not. Maybe they weren't going to have too many children. But to your second point, I think what your point is actually beautiful, the Barbanel. He's saying they did have the desire beforehand, and in fact, God wanted them to increase it.
Yes.
And so everything you're saying is right. The problem is it went overboard. That's the issue. So this is a sensitive topic, but let me say two things, and then here's where we're going to go forward. First, I want to see how this plays into the story. And I think there are certain weaknesses to it, but there's actually a great strength in this approach because I think it puts the whole thing in perspective in a certain way in terms of Adam and Eve's relationship with each other. And I want to get to that. But then I think I want to ask another question. And I think it's an important question, although, you know, it's not always something people talk about, which is what is the appropriate aim of sexual intercourse, right? What is that aim that Abarbanel speaks of? And the pleasure of it, the lust of it, is that necessarily a bad thing? Is that something that we should discourage or something that we should only see as a medium of reproduction, of producing children? I don't know. I think that's part of the question to ask here. Well, what does the Torah want us to do with our sexuality? How should we look at it? Is it something to totally avoid? It's something to only participate in for the purpose of having children. Is that the point? Is it evil, as some other cultures would have it? And like this notion of the sin of Adam and Eve bringing about sexuality into the world, does that mean that sexuality is inherently tied up with sin? The Barbanel is not necessarily saying that. So these are the things I want to investigate with the remainder of our time. Andrew, you want to say something?
Yes.
Okay.
I was just wondering whether this focus on sexuality is really just one example of what having a taste of the fruit in the Garden of Eden raised. Maybe what we're really dealing with here is more globally a different level of consciousness. And what you identified in a previous week, I think, it may have been last week or the week before, in terms of a desire to achieve certain things in life, which may not have been there before. And part of this, what may have been perceived as being somewhat embarrassment about being naked, is really not just a physical nakedness. It's a mental, it's a spiritual nakedness that Adam and Eve became conscious that of God's awareness of what they were thinking. And right. That may be much more a broader issue and embarrassment for them than sexuality per se.
I agree with everything you're saying. And the first point for sure, and I think that, you know, it's not necessarily, although I think sexuality is going to play a specific role here, but it is also representative of intensive physical or sensual pleasure or the sensual drives. So I think that's 100% true. In terms of your second point about the nakedness and embarrassment, I think there are different ways to look at that. I think you're making a good point. Paul, is it okay if you want to make a quick point? Sure.
Sorry. Just one question. Were the animals procreating at that time?
It seems like they were.
So Adam and Eve could stand by and watch.
Yeah, again, this wasn't, the Bob Rail's not saying that when they ate from the tree, they learned how to procreate. It's not what he's saying. They knew how to procreate beforehand, but it increased the desire to do so. That's what he's saying. So I want to bring this into context for a second. There are, I think, although again, you look at the word knowledge usually means I know something cognitively. It doesn't usually mean intimacy. But I think from the story itself, there are a lot of supports to the notion that here it does mean intimacy. Let's take a look at a few of them. Look at source number 3. And this is the most obvious. What happens right in chapter 4, right after the story of Adam and Eve? What's the first thing Adam and Eve do after they get clothed and they realize they're naked? V'adam yadach v'ishto. Adam had known Eve, his wife. V'tahar v'telet Kayin. And then she has Kayin. Maybe it's not a coincidence that this term yidi'ah, yada, as used in the context of intimacy, is utilized right after the story, and we talk about their childbearing right afterward, right? Now, let me point out that Rashi here says, actually, that they had known beforehand. They had known beforehand. That they had children beforehand. The Torah is bringing it up now. But I still don't think it's a coincidence. On that vein, why would yada, why would the term knowledge mean intimacy? What does knowledge have to do with sexuality? So there are a number of approaches here, but I one that resonated with me, we mentioned one, which is that knowledge is a sign of maturity, so is the desire for sexuality. Well, I think what the Netziv here says in source number 4 is maybe, to me, more meaningful. And he says as follows, Ro'oi ladat shebechol makom detib lashon nidiya gabi tashmish amita. Whenever it says the term knowledge in the context of sexuality, it implies a certain intimate knowledge between the partners, that they know each other and that they're specifically aware of the identity of each partner during the process. Meaning that the sex is not simply because of the fact that it's a partner in, you know, that one's a male, one's a female, but it's because of their relationship, because she was his wife and not anyone else. It's a personal knowledge. This means in terms of betrothal. Sometimes it can mean a certain forging of that connection. That's what it means. He knew Chava, his wife, Bishvil Sheki Ishto. It was because she was his wife. It was because they were intimate. They were familiar with each other. They knew each other on a deep level. That comes along. It wasn't simply this carnal desire. So that's in terms of the term knowledge. But in terms of the context, again, I'll point something else out. Before it says that the snake tried to seduce Chava, it says that the snake was naked. The snake was arum. Now, arum can mean cunning, tricky, but it can also mean naked. And then it says, and that's when the nachash in source number 5 tries to seduce Chava. Now, what Chazal, Rashi here, the sages do with that is very interesting. It says Rashi in source number 6, ma inyan zelikon. Why, what is this doing here? Why do we have this story here? Like, we were talking about Adam and Eve getting together and, you know, uniting and marriage. And why do we have the story of the Nachash? Hayalo lismo bayas adam. It should have just said he made them clothes because they were naked. He made them clothes. It teaches you what inspired the serpents to bother them. He saw them engaging in intercourse in front of everyone, publicly, because they weren't ashamed of it, because it was just part of their life, that they had no need for privacy. And the Nachash saw that, and he had a desire for Chava, and that's what brings about his seduction of them. Meaning that even the Nachash, even his whole endeavor is tied up with this notion of sexuality. That's what he wants out of this. That's his goal. as the sages see it. And I think they're picking up on that term arum, that the Nachash is described as naked, which means cunning, but it also means naked. Furthermore, this focus on nakedness. What happens immediately when they eat from the tree? They recognize that they're naked. Now, there are other ways to explain that, and we have in past lectures, but within this notion of gaining a certain awareness and lust for sexuality, it makes a lot of sense why all of a sudden their nakedness made a difference to them. They realize, wow, this is not just another experience. This is something that really motivates me. And it filled them with a certain shame, which I'll get to. So that's in terms of the support, okay? There is a question on this. I just want to note, I don't have the easiest answer, but there is a question on this, which is as follows. It says, in source number 8, this is Bereshit 3, Chafet, and that is what God says after the sin. So after Adam and Eve eat from the tree of intimacy, we'll call it for tonight, God says as follows. Vayomer Hashem Elokim, God said, Hin Adam haya kacha mimenu ladat tov v'ra. Man has become like me to know good and evil. Now, if we associate the knowledge of good and evil as referred to in this story with knowledge or will or a discernment or a deeper wisdom, then it makes some sense to say that they were like God. If we associate it with a desire for sexuality, not so easy to explain why God would say something like this, right? To not get too blasphemous here. It's hard to know why God would say, now that they really like each other, they're like me. So that's hard. You could read it as, and that's what the Barbanel suggests, that it's God saying, what, they think they're like me? Like, really? They think the Nachash was right? That's not being like me. The whole thing is nonsense. That's as if it's sort of a sarcastic statement. What, do Adam and Eve think they're like me now? That they have this new quality? No, not at all. But that is difficult. That's in terms of textually. But what I want to do is go back to the previous story. And I alluded to this a bunch of weeks ago, and that is as follows. Isn't it interesting that right before the story of the tree of intimacy is the story of Adam and Eve uniting? It's the story of Adam finding Eve. And I think that actually has a lot to do with the story as the Abarbanel puts it. So let's read for a minute, source number 9, which talks about this story. It says, "Vayikra Adam Shemot L'chol Havayim Al Ofa Shemayim." Men called names of all the animals and the birds. L'chol Chayat HaSadeh and all of the wild beasts. L'adam Mumat Ezer Kenegdo. And he couldn't find a fitting helper, as translated here. Vayapel Hashem Lokim Tardimah Adam. God knocks out the man. Vayishan, and he falls asleep. Vayikach achat mitzalutav, he takes one of his ribs, vayiskor basar tachtena, and fills it with flesh. Right? So something from Adam himself is taken, a part of his body. Vayiven Hashem Elokim et atzilah shelakach nadal nisha. God, the Lord God, built this rib into a woman. Vayivi'el el ha'adam, and he brought her to the man. Vayomer ha'adam, zot ha'paham, etzem me'atzamai, uvasar mivsari, lezot yikare isha ki me'ish lukachazo. Said man, this time a bone from my bones, flesh from my flesh. This is what I will call a woman because it has been taken from man. And here's the most important, what we're going to focus on. Al-Kain, therefore, yazav ish et aviv et imo, a man shall leave his father and mother, bedavak b'ishto, cleave to his wife, v'hayu levasar echad, and they will become one flesh. V'yihiyu shnehem arumim ha'adam v'ishto, v'lo yiposhashu. And then we have the story of the snake. Why is it that the Torah interrupts this story of Adam and Eve finding each other and becoming one flesh with the story of the snake? what is the relationship between these two stories? So it's not 100% simple, but according to Abarbanel, actually, I think it's very beautiful. What is this notion of men and women combining to be one flesh? What does that mean? It says that a man shall leave his mother and father and combine with his wife, and they shall be one flesh. What do you think? In what sense are they going to become one flesh? What might that mean? That they shall become one basar echad.
They're child.
Ah, so Chaim points out it might mean through the method of reproduction. And that's actually what Rashi says. Basar echad havlad notzar ayadei shnehem visham naaseb saram echad. Rashi says it actually refers to intercourse. It refers to the reproductive act by which they have a child and become one flesh. The child is a product of both of them, and that's how they become one. That's one approach. Okay? There are other approaches, though. It doesn't necessarily refer to only the act of reproduction. Take a look at source number 11. The Ibn Ezra says as follows. Vatam vayu lebasar echad shiitapku v'yashuvu kumo shehayu. They began as one person, and the Ibn Ezra says that they shall cleave to each other and return to that state of being one. To return to that unity, right? In terms of their identity, they become a unit between them. And the Ramban embellishes upon this very beautifully. V'hanochom b'inai, as a contrast, the zotapam, as a contrast to the way other animals mate, humans are different. Ki ba'behema v'chaya ein lahem dvikup v'nikvoteyen. Okay, I don't know if this is, I guess it might depend on the animal, but the Rabban says wild animals and domesticated animals do not have a connection with their wives or their partners. The male will have sexual intercourse with a female that he finds, and they go their separate ways. Since this female came from the human body itself, and he cleaved to her, and she is part of his own flesh, and he desired her to constantly be, and she wants to constantly be with him. Just as that was with Adam, who literally, as the Torah tells it, was formed from the same body as Eve, so too it shall be for their progeny. That the male should cleave to their females, their wives, leave their parents' house, and see their wives as if they were one person. So it doesn't necessarily only refer to the physical act of intercourse. It might also, or reproduction, but it refers to their identifying with one another, right? It refers to that as well. And the Sfarno, taking it one step further, or very nicely, says as follows, Hayula basar echad mechavein b'chol ha'pulot. And this is the ideal. It's not always so. But they should intend in all their activity to accomplish the perfection that was intended with man's creation. As if they were one. It's a unity of purpose. That they had the same goals and values in mind. That was the intention of creating males and females. That's the unity. So we had here a unity in the reproductive process, a unity of identity, and a unity of purpose. And I want to argue to you that those are all true and they're all connected. They're all
until connected. The divorce. Until the divorce.
Right. If everything goes right, 100%. Now, and I think divorce is a good point. And let me make a few points relating to that because you mentioned it. I think part of the point of divorce, or the allowance for it, right, is that we recognize it isn't always so, right? And that if this isn't happening, if they aren't achieving that unity, then there has to be a room for dissolving the marriage, because there is, it's we're acknowledged that this is not always so, but it is the goal of it. And I like one more point here, and I'm not saying these are easy, but I think this is the philosophy being sort of presented here. The rabbis in the Gemara in Sanhedrin see this as a prohibition, as one of the seven Noahide laws against infidelity and against illicit sexual relationships. And they say that a person will leave their mother and father, meaning literally, in terms of you cannot be with relatives, v'davak b'ishto, and ishto as opposed to zahar, you have to cleave to a wife and not a male, v'hayulavasarachad, and they have to be able to combine into one flesh, which is to exclude bestiality. That's what the rabbis read into this. Now, obviously, that's quite a loaded idea. But I think what it's getting at is that the way that the Torah sees the sexual relationship is that it involves all of these goals at once, right? That it involves the reproduction, it involves the unity, and it involves combining into one identity. But all of those need to be present in order to really have the full relationship here. And that's what's desired, which excludes other forms of the relationship, which don't share all of those aspects. But the point is, let me just make my one more sentence. The point is, all of these points build upon each other. Sexuality, intercourse, is supposed to create that connectedness, that unity, that connection between the partners, which enables them to then properly bear children. I think that's the perspective being sort of promoted by all of these interpretations. They're all right. They're all true, and they all build one upon the other. It has to be all of them. And that they're all legitimate goals, right? Which is why in Judaism, that on the one hand, sexuality is relegated to the realm of marriage, but it isn't relegated to the realm of childbearing, right? And it's encouraged far after a couple has gone beyond this age where they can bear children. And well beyond, you know, any, you may have even no notion of doing so, but there's still this notion of creating that bond and unity. Yeah, so I want to...
So if you reject same-sex marriage?
What'd you say?
So if you believe in that, do you reject same-sex marriage?
Well, I think the Torah, in rejecting homosexuality, and it does, in terms of their relationships... is as the rabbis see it, is saying that there has to be a childbearing element to, that's one of the ingredients. That's one of the ingredients that's necessary. And that's part of the relationship. So in that vein, yes, that's why it's not appropriate.
I was gonna say that even the animals have this sense of unity if they hang out together, they go to each other to mate. They also have the sense of unity as
right.
a human
well,
being.
It's a little less conscious.
It's a little less conscious. I mean, a lot less conscious, right? They're doing it under impulse more than the human being. But the idea is that they do act in similar to each other.
Right. Yeah, that's true, but. That's certainly true, and it probably depends on the animal and how, I guess, advanced they are, but, you know, I don't know if they have the same shared values and goals and identifying with each other to accomplish a common purpose in the way that the Farshmarks are describing here, but it's a good point.
Well, actually, as you talk about the common purpose, but they say opposites attract, right? So we see amongst males and females that very often they do seem like two different people, yet they do get together.
So Leonard Arve Hirsch says about this pasuk exactly that point, that it's male and female, which also goes to Paul's question, that because males and females are generally very different, that, and they each have their own, you know, strengths and weaknesses, deficiencies and talents, that the Torah says it's kinegdo, opposite him, right? That the male and females are not the same. And that's why together they can accomplish what their Sforno says, reaching for that perfection intended within humanity. It doesn't mean they have to be the same. It means they have to have a common goal, right? You can be very different, have a common goal.
So do you have to have a wife in order to procreate?
Yeah.
So how did the children of Adam create?
So you're saying, so—
Where were their wives?
So again, I mean, when you asked the question, I said, yes, I meant after the Torah was given. But as we said before, the Netziv sees the Hadam Yada et Chava Ishto as a sort of betrothal, as a sort of marriage. So maybe they did have some sort of commitment to each other. I mean, they didn't have very many options, right?
No, exactly.
Not like Adam was going to marry anyone else at the time, as the Torah tells it. So I don't find it too far-fetched. Okay.
You know, if the idea of sexuality is expressed as in the term of leida, to know, so why would the Torah use that term in with Lot and Stone, veneida otam? We should know them.
That's a good question.
A different type of knowing, I think, when you
know
your wife and when you kind of rape somebody,
wasn't much unity going on with the story of Stone. This is a good question. It's probably a borrower term, but it's a good question. So I want to move a little bit, and then we'll take some comments as we go on, because I want to bring it back. Okay, but I think we'll have time, so it's okay. Just to point at this point, so that what the Maharal says in source number 14, it's very powerful, is that intimacy, it's not just that, as we said, it's not just that it happens to be that, you know, husband and wife are meant to be unified and they also have intercourse. The intercourse, their sexuality is fundamental to bring about that unity. Look what he says here, very beautifully. He's actually addressing the notion of why on Yom Kippur, there are five things we don't do. And one of them is we don't engage in intercourse, marital relations. So he has an interesting idea here, which is that there's five aspects to the soul. And each one of the prohibitions relates to one aspect of the soul. But one of them is called the yechida. Yechida means the part of you that makes you most unique. And he says as follows, Ein achdut al ayadei tashmish. Their true unity is only through intercourse. Shenemar vayula basar echad. Because after, that's what it means when it says they shall be one flesh. The achdut zeh kasherhu mizdavegu mitchaber el ishto, when a person, and again, appropriately, has sex with his wife and connects to his wife. Az yesh kan achdus leguf. There is a unity to the body. And when there is that unity, then the soul, which is unique, resides within the body. There's a certain, this perfection brought about, this physical unity between the spouses also brings about this union between body and soul. And he says, on Yom Kippur, actually, we want to sort of separate body and soul. We want to separate from the body, and therefore we desist from marital intimacy. So that's the unity part of it. So now going back to our story, right? We have this tale of Adam and Eve who are meant to accomplish this unity with each other, right? But what happens? Then the snake comes, and the snake has other aims in mind, as we've said. And the snake induces them to eat from the tree of knowledge. And then the whole thing is changed. This whole notion is, in a sense, perverted. And that's where Rav Shimshon Nefal Hirsch here sort of talks about when he talks about the shame of nakedness. And if I ask, is the shame of nakedness a good or bad thing? Because on the one hand, they didn't have this shame before, but we recognize shame as a sort of a positive attribute in a certain sense. And I even add that there are certain thinkers who said that God wanted them to sin so that they could have this shame. That the shame needed to, it was a necessary ingredient to the way, to the human experience.
Yeah, but what they become ashamed about? What are they, what exactly are they ashamed about?
Right. So that's where Shimson or Fallhurst talks about here. He says as follows. The original condition of the first human couple is described to us in a short sentence. They were both the man and his wife naked and were not ashamed. Perhaps since it does not mean, does not, they were not to be ashamed, should not be ashamed. For as long as man and woman, both Adam, together, were basar echad, one body, serving as a single spirit, subordinate to the one God, as long as their spirit and body corresponded to the human ideal in the image of God, as long as their body was pure and holy as their spirit, the spiritual as well as the sensual, both given by God to fulfill their human determination with both. There's not, man may move in a spiritual or sensual endeavors, as long as he remains with both in the barriers consecrated by God, and with both of them observes the regulations set by God. He has neither to be ashamed of one or the other. As long as everything was appropriately calibrated, everything was subservient to a higher purpose, there was no reason to be ashamed. There was no shame involved. Everything was a perfect part of their existence. The pure human body, the morally sensual, is by no means less holy than the spirit. That's the argument here. There's nothing wrong with the body. That's an important part of the human experience. The moral greatness required by the divine law is based above all on this sanctification of the bodily human being. That's what the goal is. The goal of our religion is to sanctify the body. That even with the satisfaction of our most sensual instincts, we remain within the divine circle. And then we do not have to be ashamed of our animal body or our nakedness. But as soon as a person leaves the reins to sensuality, when we say, now I'm going to be governed by that overpowering lust, when that's in charge, does not raise a sensuality with moral energy into the circle of divine, but conversely, through sensuality, divine itself is drawn down, unfreeing the circle of sensual. If instead of uplifting the sensual drive, we bring down the spiritual drive and it's governed by that lust, immediately he has to be ashamed of his sensual nakedness. And this feeling of shame is the admonishing guardian of morality. Once we recognize that the lust takes control of our self and that it gets us to do things that we shouldn't be doing and perverts our message and our mission, that's when there needs to be a shame. It is the voice of God to the man who has withdrawn from his morally poor height to become master of the sensual body, to remain master of the sensual, and through the subordinate domination of moral freedom to the height of his divine, soar upwards. Meaning shame is really important. Shame keeps the lust in check. Shame keeps the drive in check. Now it's important. After eating from the tree, we needed to be ashamed of being naked because now we had this powerful lust. And he says something else interesting that's also important here. The Ha'adam Visho, and this is, you can see, you know, he's taking a shot at a society here, where sometimes in certain, you know, I guess the notion of boys will be boys, or as a former, you know, it is inauguration day, so I'll say, as a former president once said, oh, it was just locker room talk, that there's like a certain expectation that, oh, you men have more leeway in the way they act in this regard, and that they can be more, you know, free. But women, they have to be private. And Rupert says, absolutely not. It says, Adam Vishto, were both ashamed. Both of them, the man and his wife, were naked and they're not to be ashamed of. The deep truth is laid down there that the both man and woman should be equally pure, equally morally, equally holy, not holy only in spiritual, but also in bodily relation. Right? This is for both. This is not, there's this notion that there's more of a leeway. This notion that, you know, it's modesty is only for women is false. It's for both. But the point is, that's what changes after they eat from the tree of knowledge. There's this need for this shame. And there's a certain, we recognize this powerful drive within us, sometimes we can barely even control, that gets us to do things that we don't really want to do, that are against what we're here for. And that brings us back to the punishment that Paul mentioned before. Paul asked, why is it that women bear the pain of childbirth? Now, I'm not blaming women generally, but in the story, who is the one that gets Adam to eat from the tree of knowledge? It's Eve. It's Chava. She's the one that incites him to do that. She's the one that gives it to him. She's the one, and instead of being that Azer Kenegdo, instead of being this team in tandem trying to accomplish the will of God, she takes a turn for the worse and instead goes after and eats from the tree of knowledge, which inspires this lust. And what is her punishment? Elisha Amar, to the woman God says, Harba arbe itzvonech beheronech be'etzev teldi banim. You shall have severe pangs in childbearing, and you shall bear children with sadness. Ve'elishek shukatech, and you shall yearn for your husband, v'hu yimshal bach, and he will rule over you. There's a lot to say about that, but if you think about childbirth and a lack of comfort, a pain in childbirth, a pain in rearing children, it makes sense that that would follow from a perversion of the desire for lust. Instead of everything being in tandem and synchronous and utilized for the appropriate purpose, and childbearing being a natural outcome of a beautiful process, tied in within that is all sorts of other desires, all sorts of other motivations. And it's not totally pure. And that, I think, results in the pain of childbirth. That's what it's saying. In that sort of, you know, as in couples try, but there is this sort of tension between male and female as to, you know, the dynamics of that relationship. That tension is there because there is this lust. There is this sort of power struggle and desire that they each are trying to grapple with. And that's what the Don Isaac Barbanel says here. Why was Chava punished with these three things? Amnam b'inyan kilata achshov says, in regard to the curse of the women, I think, shahaita kefi chata midah k'neged midah, it was commensurate with her sin. Kimo itaita kilat nachash. Kilefi sha'isha achlam eitada tovara. The women ate from the tree of intimacy of good and evil. V'natna la'adam le'chol mimenu k'dei l'harbot ha'mishkal. And why did she give it to the men? In order to increase his lust. Amar Hashem Barak, God said, Eleha, Ein safek shebacharta b'zeh le'echa migimot tachliyot. You must have chosen this for three purposes. Im levakish arivut ha'mishkal v'tanugo, either to seek the pleasure of intercourse, im inyan ha'adah banim, to have children, that's why you wanted that increased lust, v'im k'dei she'elave ishech alecha v'yavecha, or that your husband should love you more. But obviously she wasn't supposed to do this in order to achieve those, and therefore she was cursed. Therefore, the process is painful. It's not as pleasurable as it might have been. Therefore, there is this awkwardness sometimes. There is a power dynamic there between husband and wife. Therefore, the experience of childbearing isn't natural and smooth. It's painful. And so I think this story that, as the Barbanel sees it, is sort of a story about the human experience of our sensual drives. And it's not just sexuality, it's all of our physical drives. It's a question of this battle. And the point he's making is, before we ate, it was easier to calibrate everything appropriately, that everything should have its purpose, that we could uplift everything, that the drive would be there to create this unity and connection between both sides of the couple, but the lust sort of makes it all difficult. And part of our job then is to return back to that point, to try as best as we can to uplift the drive and to purify our relationships and to purify every aspect of our life, to bring it into that circle that Rabbi Hirsch was describing earlier. And I think that's a big part of this notion of the story. So I think all of this has to do, again, with what it means to be human, to be a Tzelem Elohim, to be complex, to have many aspects of our lives that we have to satisfy at once, that we're physical and we're spiritual and we like different things and we have different goals and we have to figure all of that out. That is the tale of Adam and Eve and the tree of either knowledge or the tree of intimacy.
If the
thank you very much.
I'm so, Rabbi,
anyone's welcome to leave as they go.
And if the